Hey, Beth, I have a story for you. It has bonding over a shared love of cringy music, a meaningful bond that gets a little messy, and the dark cloud of don't ask, don't tell. It's a misconnection. Welcome to Misconnections. We're both Elizabeth. I'm Elizabeth Villa, aka Lizzie.
And I'm Elizabeth Windham, aka Beth.
Misconnections is a podcast that explores the longing to connect and the circumstances that stand in our way.
Each episode, we'll bring a true story of a misconnection and an expert guest to help us unpack it so that we can all get better at making real, meaningful connections that feel good to us.
That's why we started this show. After a series of our own misconnections in dating, friendships, and family relationships, we decided to get some help. So, Beth, are you ready to hear this misconnection story?
I'm definitely intrigued.
All right, let's give it a listen.
I don't usually remember how I met people, but you aren't like anyone else. We were both in the military, stationed at Shaw Air Force Base, South Carolina, and a few months after I'd arrived, I started to notice you. We had a mutual friend, our buddy Sud, and you were a soft-spoken member of his entourage I couldn't help but want to learn more about. You kept a low profile, keen on quietly keeping to yourself in the background. I later learned partly because you were self-conscious about speaking English. But I tend to gravitate towards shy and reserved people like you, the ones who try to stay under the radar. So I went right up to you at one of the midnight chow gatherings we'd hang out at and said, "Hi, who are you? Let's talk." You were the quiet one, but that's why you were the one I talked to the most. Talking to you felt precious, and I cherished every exchange. You seemed misunderstood to me, with no one else in Sud's crew bothering to connect with you or understand you the way I did. I'd invite you to hang out with me and a few of my other friends so you could be valued for who you really were, and our friendship began to blossom. You loved American music, and we bonded right away over our love of basic pop, Danny Dee Kane, Madonna, Justin Timberlake. Others rolled their eyes at this type of music, but you were the only person who loved it as much as I did. I remember introducing you to the Spice Girls and watching Michael Jackson music videos with you on YouTube. We got closer and closer through our love of music, and you began to open up to me as I gained your trust and our intimacy grew. You even taught me your real Thai name, and you drilled me on how to pronounce it correctly. In time, we had built a safety between each other that neither of us experienced with anyone else. I loved it. I loved talking with you. It was as simple as that. That's just the miracle of friendship, isn't it? Friendships never really start as something big or profound. They can grow from the smallest of seeds, like our shared love of cringy music. You'd be running at a certain speed, and then you realize someone else is on the same path as you, and they're running at the exact same speed. So then you just run together and see how far you go. Our friendship reached a level where I invited you to have Thanksgiving with me and my family back in my hometown in Georgia. I'd like to bring friends from the military back home with me for the holidays so that I wouldn't have to see my parents by myself, retreating back into the closet, repressing who I was. Having friends there brought me comfort, and there was no one more comforting than you. I remember my incredibly shy and quiet niece immediately took a liking to you, just like I had at midnight chow. You eagerly helped my dad put up kitchen cabinets and volunteered to clean up and do the dishes after Thanksgiving dinner. This kindness was all just so genuinely you. You were such a deeply good and caring person. Everything about you, even the little things, felt so special to me. I didn't see the next step in our relationship coming, though maybe I should have. I had gotten a hotel room for you, me, Sud, and a few other friends to celebrate our friend Maddie returning from deployment. We were drinking and hanging out, and I was bouncing around from person to person, being physically affectionate with everyone like I always was. I'm a touchy-feely person by nature, even with friends. So I was sitting in your lap, but when I tried to get up to get another drink, you held me a bit tighter. You looked at me. "Where are you going?" In that moment, there was a shift in the universe. We hooked up for the first time that night. I was awkward and inexperienced, but of course, you were so kind to me, as always, and to my surprise, you even wanted to do it again. As close as we had become, it hadn't even crossed my mind that you had those types of feelings for me. I was shocked that even though you knew me, the real me, so well, you were still interested in taking our intimacy into something physical. I wasn't just some guy you'd met at a club that you thought was hot. You knew me as a real person. You'd seen me at my lowest points, and you still thought I was worth being with in that way. It made me feel appreciated and accepted so fully. I'd never felt that way before. This dynamic became our new normal, but only while drunk. We had a pattern of being close friends during the day, just as we always had been, but then at night, after two shots of 151 apiece, we'd go back to one of our dorms and hook up. I'm grateful that our public-facing relationship didn't change, but it pained me that you felt like we needed to drink into oblivion in order to access the other side of our connection, drinking 151 so that we could get there and not care. I told you I wanted us to drink less, but it became clear to me that nothing further would happen between us if we didn't drink. I never wanted our relationship to just be drunken hookups. It felt like that reduced everything else we shared. I didn't know then, and I still don't know how you identify. You would tell me that your private parts were for girls, though your actions with me said otherwise. People often called me the gay whisperer, since I had a reputation of being straight guy's gay experiment. They would always end up identifying as straight afterward, but that was a safe haven for them to figure out some stuff about themselves. I wondered if this was the case with you too. Friends began to tell me that when you and I would drink too much, we'd make out openly in front of others, and that scared me. Being together behind closed doors was one thing, but being gay in public in the don't ask, don't tell era was another. I knew all too well the sorts of struggles being gay in the military could bring about, and I didn't want that for you. I didn't want to be the cause of any hardship for you or mess anything up for you and your future goals or career aspirations. I couldn't bear the thought of derailing you in any way just because of our hormones. We still continued in this way until I left the base when I took a tour of duty yonder, a TDY, for a year. When I came back, it was great to see you, but things were different. You had a girlfriend. You military guys always get girlfriends. And I was just so tired of everything. Not you specifically, exactly, but the masquerade of it all. While I was this open secret, everybody knew I was gay, yet all the guys I had been with did so in secret. I decided to get as far away as possible and went to Alaska. We kept in touch here and there through Facebook, but that marked the end of a chapter, the end of the magic period. I saw you again one more time after that. You had gotten married. You military guys always get married, and we're living in Virginia Beach. I wasn't jealous when I heard you were married. I was genuinely happy that it seemed like you had found joy. That's all I ever wanted for you, after all. I was able to stop by for a visit while on a road trip, and you, me, and your wife rode bikes up and down the beach. You originally wanted to go clubbing together, just you and me, but I had misgivings about what that would entail. All I wanted was to catch up and reconnect as friends, and not soil any of that with the mess of potentially hooking up with a married man. My priority with you has always been our friendship. That's what mattered the most to me, and I never wanted to jeopardize that. I've had so many other relationships that were ruined by sex, and I would hate for that to be our fate. I also wanted to preserve what I valued most about our bond, which was that we loved each other as people, not as bodies. It would be devastating to find out that you look back at our relationship as just sex, when I look at it as so much more. I haven't seen or heard from you since. I deleted my Facebook, which was my main source of contact with you, but you haven't tried to find me any other way. It breaks my heart a little, because I still think about you a lot. I saw my niece, my quiet niece, recently, and reminisced about how much you two had bonded when you came to our Thanksgiving. I hope you're doing well. I hope you're happy. I hope you're surrounded by people who care about you and value you, because I know not everyone always has. Too many of my friendships and relationships have gone up in smoke and ended in trauma, but not with you. With you, it all just ended. I still feel nothing but goodwill, love, and affection for you. And that's why I miss you even more. What's your life like now? Are you a father? Are you still in the military? What do you do? I wish you were still around. I've never met anyone else who has even reminded me of you, or has offered something similar to me as a friend the way you did. There's an absence that I'm living with now that you're gone. I wish I could get your outlook and opinion on random things. I wish we could still talk about pop music and what the weather's like. I just want your friendship again.
So Beth, tell me, how are you feeling listening to this story?
I have a kaleidoscope of emotions in regards to the story. First, just really appreciate the storyteller, and I want to give them a big hug. The way in which he describes this relationship is like tender and soft, despite both of them living in this like hard military world, which I think is special. And I can also relate with the storyteller in the way that they describe the feeling of being seen and known when it seems like they've had to mask for the majority of their lives.
Right.
And just the fact that, like, in the context that he's gay in the military during the don't ask, don't tell era, you know, he's had to censor himself at such an extreme measure to be in that world. But, you know, as the story continues, we see that even this relationship where he feels seen and known, there's still some hesitation. There's still some masking. It's like, it's as if he can only be 75% of himself with this person. And it's mostly out of safety, you know, that he continues to have to be somewhat censored with this special relationship. And while I'm happy that the storyteller has a lot of fondness towards this relationship, I'm left with the feeling that I really hope that they have or will be able to have a relationship in their life that they can be fully 100% themselves and not have to mask and not have to censor. I want a space of freedom for them fully. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and maybe he already has.
Yeah, exactly. Like maybe he has, which I hope for that.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, I, you know, as we were listening to the story, I really wanted to provide a little bit of the backstory of how we even came across this story, because what strikes me about this story is how it feels to be kind of a fly on the wall as he is looking back on a relationship that was almost like frozen in time.
Yeah.
An important, meaningful relationship that existed in this specific chapter of his life. And I want to share that I actually just kind of reached out to this storyteller after hearing in passing a couple of comments about his quest for more connection.
Yeah.
And I just kind of asked, like, how do you feel about connection? Are there any stories in your life that you feel like represent a bit of that journey for you? And this story came up for him.
Yeah.
And so we really did, in the process of interviewing him and spending time with him and then writing this essay and him recording this essay, we actually were a part of the process of him looking back.
Yeah.
And so it feels very important to acknowledge that, because it feels like he's doing that with an openness to really just wonder about it.
Sure.
And he's holding space for that fondness. He's holding space for what is hard about it, and he's really looking at who he was at that time of his life. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is so incredibly important and brave, and something that I am all too unwilling to do in my own life. So it is, you know, really, really special to be a part of.
Yeah.
And it's also a story with a lot of layers. Mm-hmm. So the setting for this story, as you mentioned, is in an American military base. It's told from the perspective of a gay Black man. It's during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era.
Yeah.
And all of this together represents some, but still not all, of the context for this connection.
Yeah.
And context is something we're really curious about when it comes to connections.
Yeah.
How does who we are, where we live, where we come from, the communities we belong to, how our families operate, our relationship history, and so on impact the ways that we connect? So for this next part of the episode, we're going to bring in a special guest to help us dive in.
Yes, we are.
Ocean Shapiro is a trauma therapist at Woven Together Trauma Therapy. They work with couples and individuals and specialize in dissociative disorders, religious trauma, and cult survivorship, as well as working with 2S LGBTQIA+ folks and those with poly, platonic, kink, and other alternative relationship formation issues. They are also a consultant for Sensitive Revolution, an organization that works with leaders to cultivate insight and self-awareness. You might recognize Ocean and their amazing voice from an earlier mini episode where they helped us answer a listener question about connecting in open relationships. Welcome back, Ocean.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be back.
We are so grateful. Ocean, we'd love to know, how did you feel listening to this story? What did it make you think about?
I cry every time I hear it. So that's one. What did it make me think about? It made me think about the longing for someone reaching back out to you to know how you are, to know how you connect to the world around you, to know how you connect to yourself, that he didn't get that is what really sticks with me by the end of this story, as well as just this feeling of being the gay experiment that really kind of hits me in the chest. There's something about feeling human, feeling seen as a human, and yet being a playground for other people to try out before they graduate in life. And then reflecting back and seeing, oh, that's the one where we didn't just end. Something about this continued within me and I still care. It feels like we're getting an insight into them as they've become who they are, looking back on when they didn't feel like they ever got seen as such. It's really touching.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
Yeah, cue me crying every time we hear all of these stories. And this one is no different. Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought that up. Obviously, I already mentioned that I appreciate about what the storyteller was really in the process of looking back. And just as you said, that process is complicated.
Yeah.
Because there's like past relationships, especially meaningful ones that exist in certain chapters of our lives, can feel a little bit like time capsules. And like, who wants to dig that up? It's like the not fun time capsule sometimes. Like maybe there's not buried treasure. I don't know what people typically put in time capsules, but he, you know, has the courage to really dig that up. And that is really hard because it can exist in, you know, frozen our memories in a positive way, holistically, or in a negative way. And to dig that up means being open to the complicated layers of that. And so I'm wondering, just as we get started, what are we missing out on when we keep those time capsules buried in our own lives? Like, especially if we don't have closure, especially if there's a part of it that sticks with us over time.
Closure is a privilege, and it's also something that doesn't always happen. I think it's something that's really important when you feel like you have a right to your own sense of self-discovery, which a lot of people don't, because they're marginalized, because of their position in society, because of what they've been taught as they've grown up, right? Because of their familial relationship to the self versus the we. And so I find that if you feel like you have a right to that sense of self-discovery, those time capsules, when they come up, it's almost like, okay, now I can look at that with a more informed sense of all of who I am and also what I mean to other people, what I mean to myself as someone who's graduated and grown throughout time. If I don't feel like I have that right to examination of the self, then closure can be really important because it kind of gives me an opportunity. It's a little bit like the end of a chapter, but like arbitrated by time. I get to feel like this is the moment where I look into who I am. This is when anyone would do that. Maybe it's the time for me. And so not going through that experience of either of examining the self or getting the opportunity to think that this is a chapter that's closed, I think we're really missing out on understanding the ways in which we show up, the ways in which other people show up in our lives. And it's a little bit of why we ask for what we need and being in touch with what we actually are asking for in that process and whether or not we even get it in the first place. We just miss out on that whole kind of area of life, which seems like it'd be really big, but for a lot of people, they don't feel clued into it either because they don't feel they deserve it or because no one ever broke down for them that they had a right to it.
So you're saying that those chapters inform the future story.
Yeah.
And by not having the opportunity, access, awareness to read them, if we keep going with this, then we're missing out on understanding even what's going on in our current story today.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I 1000% agree on the fact that it's also privilege, you know, to have that closure. Because again, like you said, it depends on where they're at emotionally, physically, mentally, and the people around them. And when you are able to have closure, whether it's with an individual or within yourself, it is so lovely to then look back on these different relationships, these different situations, and say, thank you and goodbye. You know, kind of like Ariana Grande, thank you next, but like in a very kind way, and then continue to progress forward and continue to like learn about who you are as a human and the potential of other relationships in their present or future.
And not to be too lofty here, I don't mean that who you are only exists in opposition to something else that you were or to another relationship that you've had with yourself or with other people or with society at large, right? But you've existed throughout your entire life. So being able to look back and say, at this point in my life, this is where I was, and now I'm here, there's some amount of power to that that then fuels into, and this is who I can become, right?
One of the reasons we were so grateful to tell this story is because it really offered a chance to zoom out from the interpersonal pieces of the misconnection, instead look at the bigger picture. The ways our individual and situational contexts are a part of our connections. It is impossible to talk about the story without acknowledging how the military as an institution impacted this connection, how the anti-gay policy of don't ask, don't tell impacted this connection, or how the storyteller brings us into many more layers of context that were all a part of it. So to be in that space of zooming out, we'd love to dig into why context is important for understanding relationships. What are some examples of types of context that can shape the way we as unique individuals connect?
So I was thinking about this a lot during the story. I feel like there's a couple layers of context that we would be remiss to skip past. One is there's this concept of the black holder of pain, right? And so a lot of the time in a relationship, no matter what the context is, we see kind of the black person as inhumanely strong. They're so much stronger than other people. They can hold so much trauma. They can hold so much too much too fast that they just become the person who's not just the playground, but also, oh, I can hold all of the punishments that might happen as a result of people finding out about us, but I don't want you to hold it, right? And so that's one layer of context. It's just, who are we? Are we a person in this story? Or because of just simply being black, are we someone who's holding pain instead? Are we a container? Then there's also the context of the military, right? And so we're talking about a community where people are supposed to favor the whole over the individual. And that impacts identity because that means that my identity gets foregone in favor of the collective. It's more important for me to fit into this community than it is for me to express myself as an individual. So that's another layer where then if we combine those two and we're looking at someone who's black and gay and mask, it's so interesting. When the storyteller says that he isn't out at home, that really stands out to me because I'm thinking, wow, no one really talks about the freedom of being out in the military, especially during Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And for him, he was out. And yet for a lot of people, we might not think of that as out today, especially in LA, Yes. Right? We think, oh, well, he had to be closeted, and yet that's where he was allowed to be himself. What gay was for him, what being out of the closet was for him, and what being out of the closet could be for anyone during that period could mean clandestine physical intimacy. Mm-hmm. That's all that's going to be. I think it's so poignant that he points to, this was such a good friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The time that we spent together was precious to me, right? There was still freedom for identity, but that identity was heavily constricted by what was happening at the time. I can be gay, but I can't be gay out loud. I can be Black and gay, but I can't be Black and gay at home. Mm-hmm. All of these things play a role in how I show up to my relationships, how I show up as myself, when I feel fully expressed, when can I acknowledge the self versus when is it more important in my mind to acknowledge my partners or my community.
Obviously, this story gives us an opportunity to interrogate all of our context. So I'd be curious on how we could help others listening to this start that process of beginning to peel back the layers of understanding our own context.
I love this question. I think that a lot of understanding the context we live in comes from looking back, right? So for instance, how do my parents, how do their parents, how do my ancestors, how did they express themselves and navigate the world? And if I look at that, how am I navigating the world? A lot of the times, spoiler alert, it's similar, right? So I'm enacting a lot of the same types of relational conflicts, disputes, but also types of resolution and repair that they did. At the same time, which rules am I following? And why do I think that those are rules that I have to follow? They have to do with whether or not I see my race as prescient to the conversation, my gender identity, my sexual orientation. What does sexual orientation mean to me? Do I see it as a relevant modifier of my experience, right? Do I see where I came from and having moved, or my neighborhood, as important to how I express myself? Where am I allowed to express myself? All of these things are questions that kind of help us peel back, okay, so who do I really think I am in comparison to this person that I'm in relationship with, or this person I would never be connected with, right? How do I see myself in relation to who I can be? Has a lot to do with what I see as my own context. So I almost think that New Year's resolutions are a great point of reference.
Okay. Tell me
now
more.
That I'm thinking about it.
Explain.
Because it's almost like you're setting yourself up for who you think you can be, but who you think you can be is heavily mediated by who you think you are. And what do you think you're allowed to strive for? It's kind of like January 12th is like the day everyone supposedly gives up.
The 12th specifically?
Literally, that's the average date on which New Year's resolutions end.
That's hilarious.
Shout out to
also,
any of my clients.
Far longer than any of mine have lasted. So
literally, when my clients are like, oh my God, something lasted a month, I'm like, good for you.
Yes,
like,
yeah,
that's insane. So by the 12th, do you see that as the end date on what was possible for you? Every year? Is that all that you're going to give yourself? Do you give yourself 2 weeks? Do you give yourself 2 months? Do you give yourselves a year? Do you give yourselves 2 years? Like the idea of even how much space you have to grow is so dependent upon who you think you are, what you think you can achieve, what you think other people think you can achieve, and like society at large, where you think you're going to end up.
Part of what feels complicated about that is also kind of going back to what you said, reflecting on the story, is that our context isn't necessarily like a fact that you're finding. Like it is based on how you understand it. It is based on how you are interpreting it. It's based on how someone else is interpreting your own context. And one of the things that you mentioned in that list of potential types of context is community. And it's something that you brought up when we were talking initially about this story, about the importance of talking about community. And you said specifically these concepts of me versus we, or communalism versus individualism, and how like the structure and health of the communities we're brought up in or opt into can impact our understanding of who we are and how we connect. So can you explain those concepts and how they can impact our connection to self and to others?
Absolutely. So I really like this concept because it gives a lot of freedom for in any relationship that we're ever going to be in, one person is going to be more to one side and the other more to the other. And we can actually switch.
Okay.
But generally, were raised in one of two camps, mm-hmm. leaning more to one side or the other, either the me or the we. And the me is more about separateness, uniqueness. I'm defined by me and what's unique about me versus others. And then the we side is I'm defined more by fusion, by connectivity, right? So how am I defined by other people around me and what we share, our rules of engagement, so to speak? And which side we fall on, which is kind of like individualism and communalism, right, mm-hmm. is going to dictate how much we feel we can achieve, but also how far we feel we can stray from that context versus whether or not that context is actually really important to us, right? And I think the story is a really good example of that. If the military and making sure that your partner is still able to be in it is more important to you than being gay, the uniqueness, the me in mm-hmm. this case, even though lots of people were gay at the time,
sure.
is going to be less important than your community. It's going to be less important than getting punished. It's going to be less important than getting someone else in trouble for expressing that uniqueness. So we dictate ourselves more by the fusion in that case, the connection that we feel with others. And even if you feel interpersonal connection in that context, your communal connection is going to reign supreme.
Mm-hmm. That really, it sat with me a lot after we chatted initially thinking about that because of being raised in like a religious environment.
Yeah, definitely.
And the journey of feeling most strongly connected with that community portion and understanding very clearly like what are the rules for staying in
yeah.
and belonging in the only way that I understand how to belong, which is a part of this singular community. And so kind of starting my journey on one end of that spectrum that you're talking about, and then slowly inching further and noticing how that has impacted my ability to connect. And so interesting that in that initial version where the allegiance and the, you know, that centering was around this religious community and the way that my family was involved in that, that as I inched away, my actual relationship with my family improved, which I know is unique because oftentimes it can be very hard and very difficult. But I think that the individual connections that I was able to have then improved because they were not built on a rule book. They were built on the ability to see mm-hmm. each other as an individual as well. And so I wonder how you've maybe even seen that in your work. You work with, you know, like you were saying, religious trauma and cult survivorship, and how that journey from being in a community that is requiring you to almost like betray yourself to belong, how that journey can really look like for them, or what that journey can look like for them.
I'm really hearing dark to light. I just, I was like, because I was going to start with, you can find so much connection in the community. You're like, no,
yeah,
when it's traumatic.
Let's take a step back.
We do have that tendency.
We do. We look at the morbid.
Yes. No, but it's true. So that's the interesting thing. The promise of the we is that don't worry. You're absolutely connected within this slim context, this sliver of human experience,
mm-hmm.
right? If we exist here, it's especially in a religious community. If we exist with God, gods, deities, right? In alignment with what they want for us, then you have abundant connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this sense of, if I stray away from that, if any of that doctrine was hurtful for me, if any identity came up that didn't fit within that space, then as I start to split, even though I feel like I'm probably moving towards something that will allow me the ability in the me to be myself, A, I don't know who that self is.
Mm-hmm.
B, I feel lost. Ironically, as I move toward freedom, I feel lost.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, usually I'm so happy that your family was like, let's make some connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been a misconnection.
Yeah.
But as we're moving along that spectrum, a lot of the time it puts more pressure mm-hmm. on people who see you, frankly, as walking away from an abundance of not just togetherness, but knowing.
Mm-hmm.
right? There's this whole like annoying concept that I hate because I hate jargon in psychology called the nurturance of being known. Mm-hmm. And essentially, as we are young, like really, really young, and we grow to having speech, we're asking to be mirrored in our experience so that we see our reality as existing and being real, mm-hmm. right? So redundant, but basically what that means is that when a four-year-old says truck and you don't mm-hmm. respond, and then they start to say it like they're in a play, like truck, mm-hmm. they're saying it because they want you to say, yes, there is a truck. It exists. You mm-hmm. exist. Your eyes are accurate. And so if I move away from like the communal truck,
yeah,
then yeah, I'm going to experience people thinking I'm crazy, mm-hmm. which that's not the identity I wanted.
Right.
That's not at all why I did this. In fact, it is crazy making to separate myself from you. And yet I have to do it because this hurts me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It means that my pain is not seen, right? It's just like on both sides, there's struggle. And then by the time I'm interacting with people that are trying to break out of these communities that didn't actually, the fusion wasn't good. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. fusion meant giving up parts of themselves. Then we're trying to go through and see what was helpful, what had a positive impact, what was truthful, what are traditions that you still want. It all directs back to the you. And it's like I'm talking to someone who has suddenly realized that they're allowed to have a you. Yeah. They're allowed to have a me. So I guess that's the dark side. But there is this piece of this conversation that I don't want to be lost, which is that in community, we can feel a huge sense of self, and that self being shared can actually be like, I mean, that's a gift that we don't generally have, especially in the States, right? And yet it's a spectrum. You kind of want to be in the middle. Mm-hmm. Right? You don't want too much fusion. You don't want too much separateness. You want to feel like you have both connection and protection of the self.
Yeah. Throughout this conversation, I keep on oscillated from like, am I jaded or am I too optimistic? Because I
Where'd you land?
Really thinking critically about this word and this concept, community. And similar to what Lizzie grew up in, I grew up in a religious context to which I was in a community, but yet they were teaching hyper-individualism, and also that connection and relationship was specific to, you know, like one entity. Mm. So to me, it's a little bit of a mindfuck. Like, was I truly in community? Like, maybe yes, because there was other humans, but like, is that truly what community is when it's a conglomeration of people who are being told that they have to be so hyper-individualistic that they are not necessarily safe to question or ask or seek comfort, help, ideas, you know? So
wait, can I ask, what is hyper-individualistic like mean in that context? Because that's actually so foreign to me hearing you
say
that.
I am right there with
you,
Beth.
Okay. So I would say the hyper-individualism is that for you to get answers or seek understanding, there's only one source to have that. And so like, it's upon you and that other entity in order to make that happen. And so that if you're in a community situation where they're teaching that and you're not actually experiencing that, it makes you feel like something is off and wrong with you specifically. So maybe that's my skewed version of hyper-individualism is you're like isolated.
For understanding so that it's on you
yes.
to navigate what this community has decided yeah. is important.
And there isn't safety.
But there's actually not support or safety mm-hmm. or.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a spectrum, but yeah. I'm so glad you bring this up because it's generally kind of a loophole, mm-hmm. right? So if the community fails, guess what? You are the person that had an individual connection to whatever we see as powerful. That could be God, that can be doctrine and rules, that could be a sense of self, mm-hmm. right? And so if anything bad happens to you, your connection was bad. You just weren't clued in enough. You weren't taking care of yourself. So you blame you and then come back to us when you're ready, right? And it's like, wait, I thought we were all a community. Yeah, we are, until you mess up by getting hurt, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, oh God, as soon as we get to a point where we feel that sense of, wait, but maybe I'm not wrong for being in pain, that split from that community looks like, well, now you're just tearing yourself away from everyone you know. Mm-hmm. You're causing yourself even more pain. Why don't you just like grow up a little bit? You're supposed to be supporting all of us in this venture of individualism together. It's a mind fuck.
No? It is a mind fuck.
Yes. So yeah.
And my mind is going. So.
Right? Yeah. But I do find it's also part of like, I mean, it's part of purity culture. It's a part of a lot of religious kind of frameworks mm-hmm. where, oh, that happened to you. Pray for repentance. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I'm so sorry that like God wasn't there in your time of need. Still have faith. Right? And like, all of these structures, again, can be incredibly positive and supportive for folks. But when there is wrong, who takes accountability? Who's supposed to take accountability? Mm-hmm. What does that generally look like on the whole?
And also the consequences of wrongness.
Yes.
You know, the threat of what happens when you're wrong. What will happen to you?
This is in a connection. Everyone should expect rupture. We're going to have an argument, especially in LA. But it's about repair. How do we repair? And if in your community you do not have a set way of repairing, I go, that's not a community. That's a trap.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I think that's one of the reasons that we're all sitting here thinking about community, and like you both have already said mindfuck, right?
Yeah.
And we're kind of peeling back those layers, and it's really hard to examine that relationship for yourself. And so just those initial questions that you just offered is such a helpful frame for how to understand where maybe where your community sits on a scale. Maybe it's the communities that shaped you, the communities that you're choosing, and to understand how they're impacting you. Is this a healthy, safe place to be where I can connect? Is this a place where I am, you know, obligated yet isolated? And so are there other ways that you work with clients to start to examine that for themselves? Are there questions that you might even just offer to listeners to start to wonder about in their own experiences?
So one question just along these lines of, is it helpful, is also, am I allowed to have doubts? Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to believe everything 100%, right? And this goes, by the way, for also if I'm operating more on the me side of things.
Yeah.
Right? Am I allowed to doubt myself? I should be. God forbid we live in like an unexamined life, right? Like, yeah. You should be able to look at your actions, look at what's happening around you, and critically examine them. If you're not, no matter what your context is, something's wrong, right? And so that's part of it. Another part is, how am I allowed to express myself? Just generally. So beyond doubt, are there rules for what I think will be best in terms of how I present? Do I need to perform more than I get to exist? And then when it comes to relationships, what is a relationship supposed to look like? Based on what? Who is going to judge me if that's not what occurs, right? All of these questions, it's like, first and foremost, what is the ideal? Second, who will judge me or what will go wrong if that ideal is not met? And by asking ourselves those questions, we can figure out who gave us the script. Right? If it's more us, tweak it. I can give you explicit therapeutic permission. If it's more on the side of the community, ask people questions, right? If it is safe to do so. And if it's not, also huge red flag.
Yeah.
Right? Because always trust your fear. Yeah. And I mean that in the way of, if you think there's a threat of violence, we are definitely not in a safe community.
Yeah.
If you think that other people will expel you from the community, that is violence. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're able to ask someone and they go, ooh, what do you mean? You're questioning how we're supposed to operate as human beings. Whoops, that's another yike. We want to move away from that, mm-hmm. right? Or we want to have conversations with people that have thought about this more at a minimum and then decide what our next step is. But being able to figure out who even holds those answers is really helpful, mm-hmm. right? If not you, then who? Mm-hmm. And how much power do they need to have, and why did you not have that power? These are the types of questions to deconstruct and peel back those layers, I think, that are helpful to start with.
So, so helpful. Beth, do you think that we should go light now?
Yes.
Let's go light. I mean, Ocean, so incredibly grateful for like all of those tools that you just offered.
Yes.
I think that, you know, we will be thinking about those things. Our listeners will be thinking about the questions that you asked to bring it back to connection and the opportunity that connection brings into our lives. Today, we've talked a lot about how community and context can impact connection, but does it also work to flip the script? Can connection also contribute to healing?
Yes.
Oh, ding, ding, gosh. Ding is the answer we were hoping for.
I love it. I literally am like, I brought notes because I love talking about healthy relationships. No, healthy repair, right? So when we were talking about if there's no repair, no script for it, run. At the same time, so usually what I see is that if people have experienced, and I say too much too fast just as a signifier of, that's how I define trauma, right? When we've had a lot of too much too fast in our lives, generally repair after a disruption in connection with ourselves or others looks like either asking for an apology for having been caused an extensive amount of pain after we've held, frankly, too much for any individual to bear and not getting it, or apologizing not for what we've done, believed or real, but who we are, right? And that's not repair. Repair is two human beings going, look, we're pretty flawed and I care about you, so we're going to try better next time, all right? And agreeing to that. And if we don't, we part ways because we know that this isn't healthy for us. So like every time we have connection that allows for healthy repair, doesn't matter how much we disconnect, doesn't matter how many arguments that we get into, so long as we can healthily acknowledge and like have those conversations with care and then come back together, it gives us an opportunity to heal. It gives us an opportunity to flip the script in action and just really talk about who we are, what we need, and try and negotiate getting there while we also consider someone else. And that actually helped. It's like almost like we're sharing in those moments, we're creating a context of our own, right? But we're also getting to see how we interact with the world around us and a lot more about consent, right? Like a lot of these things that we're talking about to me kind of come down to, where do I feel like I end and someone else begins?
Yeah.
Where do I feel like I end and a situation begins? Right? Because then I can say no to what I don't want. I can say yes to what I do want. I can invite in with graciousness. And I can also say no and keep my boundaries knowing that that's where I am and that's okay. So all of this type of connectivity, even being able to sit with myself and go, you know, I don't like the way that today went. Tomorrow I actually need, or right in this moment, I need different conditions for engagement with myself. Oh, now we're healing.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that connection is, that's the way that we heal.
I like to think about each of those individual moments as new templates.
Yeah.
So like you're creating a new template. I go into a lot of conversations in relationships with like notes and like a script because I'm like, I don't know how to do this and get a different reaction than I've gotten my whole life. And my responsibility isn't your reaction, but I'm training myself how to enter this space. And when you meet me there in a way that does have that opportunity for repair, that's now a template that I have to bring into a next conversation with someone else and to know that this template matters and somebody else's response to that is understanding how they fit or don't fit for me and in my life. And so I love that you gave all of those examples because I do think that in our own experiences, when we learn that things happen certain ways and those ways are traumatic or painful or hurtful, we do have to train ourselves or create new opportunities, create new templates, and that amount of healing is really life-changing, even in those tiny moments, like you were saying, with yourself, the opportunity to be aware and to adjust. You have given us so much to think about. Yes. I'm sure our listeners feel the same way. Thank you, Ocean, for joining us.
Oh my gosh, you are so welcome.
We want to end this episode by hearing from our amazing storyteller once again. We asked him what he thought he missed from this misconnection. He said, "I just wish he was around. I wish I could get his outlook, his opinion on random things, and just talk about songs that are popular and what the weather's like. I just want that friendship again."
We also believe that for every misconnection, there can be something gained. Our storyteller said, "I pay attention to people in my social circle that I might be overlooking. People who are around who I just never bothered to know because they weren't the more magnetic personalities. Thinking about what a great person he was and yet how often he was overlooked makes me try to be more considerate of how I might be taking some people for granted who are just always around, but not actually trying to get to know them or see who they are as a person. This is Miss Connections. Thanks for listening. I'm Elizabeth Windham.
And I'm Elizabeth Villa. Special thanks to this week's guest, Ocean Shapiro, and our truly amazing storyteller. You know who you are. If you'd like to learn more about Ocean, visit woventraumatherapy.com or look for Ocean on inclusivetherapists.com.
This episode's story essay was written by Charlotte Beach, and the story was voiced by our lovely storyteller.
Miss Connections is co-hosted, produced, and edited by us, the Elizabeths, Elizabeth Villa and Elizabeth Windham.
And special shout out to Podhead Studios for supporting us in production this episode.
Our theme music is Feeling by Daniil Musto.
Have a Miss Connection story to share with us? Email us at elizabeths@missedconnectionspod.com. And follow, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.